Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. Thank you, everybody who joined us on the air last week, by the way. Sure appreciate that. Funny, it's generated quite a bit of response, almost all positive. You know, this whole idea of how to share spots, what to do, why to do it, and all of that. We'll be addressing that a little bit in this version of the Upland Nation podcast as well. But a lot of folks went out on a limb, if you will, or went on the record to support helping fellow hunters, especially newcomers. And hey, blue ribbon to all of you. If we were hunting together, I'd share one of my spots with you. We got a lot to talk about. We got a pro guide who will give us some tips on how to take our dogs to the next level. This is from somebody who does it all day, all season. We'll also take your hunting reports, a poll on the biggest issues facing the future of hunting. Our Handle It segment is all about treats. And a warning, a heads up, if you will, for all of you who use those mobile mapping apps to help you access public ground. Okay, first off, been a fascinating week for a bunch of reasons. Have gotten out, not near as much as I wish I had, but suffice it to say, everything's going well. shot a double on Huns again. Happens every once in a while, and I'm glad for that, but I'm also glad that you all are getting out a lot, too. So let's get right to your Monday morning debrief. Pardon me. Lots of great stuff on the Facebook page. If you want to get involved, go to either one, Wing Shooting USA or Upland Nation. Christine Schwartz is training in, well, it looks like they dumped a bunch of snow on half your field, Christine, but we're all going to be in that mode real soon. Dan Lenson, happy birthday to Rambo. He's 4 years old. Man, it is a good-looking Labrador. Big square head, stocky but not tubby. Jeff Barker shot, looks like a ring neck. Hard to say from here, but that's a good photo of you, Jeff. You're looking good out there. Aaron, I'm going to call your last name L'Infante. And there's a chucker held by a young man in the snow. Yeah, that is looking good. Keep up the good work, both of you. Ron Funk, that's a beautiful picture of your short hair on a point. Don't see a lot of those, to me at least, to the colorblind guy here. It looks like a black and white short hair. Derek Yackel, nice mixed bag there. Some Sharpies and some... No, wait a minute. They can't be. No. Chuckers and something else, and it's kind of hard to see. Let me make it bigger here. Okay, it looks like probably a preserve hunt. But anyway, Derek, glad you're getting out. Dwayne Walls, nice shot of you guys in the background, barely visible in all your camouflage, with a black lab in the foreground with a duck in his mouth. And then Don Miller, another, you know, it must be that time of year, and you guys clue me in on that, but waterfowl season. Another one from Don Miller, a line of, it looks like pheasants in the snow with a couple beautiful short hairs in the foreground there. Keep up the good work, everybody. Love to see your pictures. It's your chance to show off, especially if you're taking a kid or if you're helping people in one way or another out there. Always good to see that, and I'd love to share it with everybody else. So just keep them coming. All right, Trent Lighter is just about ready to come on with us. In the meanwhile, let me remind you that the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, crafted at the highest caliber. Hey, if you do nothing else, go to sageandbreaker.com to see some of the best pictures of bird dogs ever. Fred Bohm and his friends have taken some incredible, you know, the kind of pictures you want to frame. They're all right there, so enjoy that. I'm trying to share them when they're on social media so you can get a taste of them there. Also, find out about the gift cards that are available. Remember, Valentine's Day, and always, always free shipping. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. All right, so let's get right to it. Takema, Nebraska is our destination today. Pheasant Bonanza, if you watch the Wing Shooting USA television show, you've seen all the guys from that place on the show several times. Thank you, Trent Likelighter, for your hospitality over the years. It's always good to hear from you. How the heck are you?
I am doing just fine. I am better than I deserve. Little yeah. Dave Ramsey action there.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely true, and good for you. Pheasant Bonanza has been a fixture in that part of the country for a long time. And the quick backstory, as you know, but many listeners may not know, I was actually hunting at a lodge in Montana, and I met a dog that just wowed me for all sorts of reasons. He was very young at the time. He had showed up that day. We hunted with him the next day, and he did such an incredible job of being a sport that I found out he'd arrived from Pheasant Bonanza, and you guys were turning out a lot of great short hairs, among other things, and he came out of that line, and I thought, someday I'll go there and hunt with his cousins and uncles and aunts and everybody else, and sure enough, we've pulled it off a few times. Trent, let's start with that. Tell us a little bit more about the operation over there, Pheasant Bonanza.
So we are in northeast Nebraska, which is, as Scott can attest to, is a lot different than central and western Nebraska. We have the hills from the Missouri River Basin, and it's really neat. The rolling hills and the bluff just kind of makes it a little bit more, I guess, easy on the eye. It's just not the flat pancake Nebraska. So we have some really neat terrain, and we have about 5,000 acres. We're at 4,900 this year, and we primarily focus on upland bird hunting, but we do also offer waterfowl hunting when the birds are here, deer hunting, turkey hunting, and we actually do a little bit of a lot of dog training. So,
do you ever? And let's not neglect all the other things out there, because you have a world class target shooting facility, and as you said, breeding and training kennels that are incredible in many ways. Your dogs end up all over the place, don't they?
We do. We ship them. We actually were just doing a pickup in Ohio. We actually is bringing in a little bit different line to our German Shorthairs, but we're shipping to California, down to Texas quite often, up north. We've even had a few dogs go into Canada, and we've had a few, actually we had about six of them go down to Mexico. So a little bit, kind of throughout the whole United States, and our puppies, they might end up, half the litter might end up local, and the other half might end up in a destination that's through plane or through a dog hauler.
And just that everybody understands how incredible these birds at Pheasant Bonanza, we'll talk about that next, but the dogs are, they're quite often going to commercial hunting operations where the rubber meets the road all day, all season, and these dogs better deliver. Am I right on that?
You are right. Yeah, we actually, that's one of our markets, is we reach out to other clubs, and as you were mentioning before, I believe it was Red Bank where you were filming that show, but out there in California, we send quite a few to clubs, and they're ready to, just like you said, as soon as they drop on site, they're ready to, a little bit of orientation with the guy that's going to be handling, and they might be guiding in 2 days from when they show up.
Yeah, and I've written about that, and in fact, I'm going to recall that story in another magazine real soon, so watch for that. But Duke impressed me so much that I've changed my view on short hairs completely. They don't need eyebrows and a beard. So we're going to talk mostly about dogs, but we're lucky enough to have you, who, number one, is an incredible shooter as well. In fact, you do your own trick shooting. And so why don't we start with the dog thing and go from there? What is it about dogs and bird hunting that really gets you worked up?
For me, dog, without a dog, hunting is not the same. And so I love the whole art of handling a dog out in the field. And just like I said, if I can't have a dog out there, the hunt and just a little bit less value to me. I really love watching dogs do what they're bred to do. And for me, that is the highlight. I don't need to carry a gun. Like you said, I do love to shoot. I do the trick shooting and the clay shooting, and I love to shoot birds just as much as anybody, but I don't have to shoot the birds. I'm happy being behind and guiding or just even watching the hunt.
When you're doing that, and let's just focus on that for a while, what are the things that you think are most important that you do that we really ought to do more of, or we ought to do if we're not doing it at all, when it comes to handling dogs during a hunting situation?
So I'm actually going to go on the opposite side of that. I hear, when I watch people handle their own dogs and just go to maybe a guest lodge, I notice that the handlers overhandle. Mm-hmm. And I see it in dog trials. I see it in, you know, the tournament hunting dog trial format is they're always calling their dog. They're always, you know, chip here, chip here, chip here, blowing their whistle. I mean, it almost sounds like, you know, a parade going through the field. And I actually think if you just let this dog go, I mean, there's obviously a fine line. Distance, you know, we don't want a dog 200 yards ahead of us, but there's a lot of times these handlers can't figure out why their dog won't leave them, and they're hunting next to them, and then they end up being a boot shiner. Well, they need to just shut their mouth every once in a while and not overhandle. So I'm actually on the opposite side of that. I notice a lot of overhandling in the field.
You know, I can echo that, especially later in the season. You've probably seen the same thing. The less stealthy one is, the more likely the birds are going to get up out of range. And I learned it again last weekend. The only birds we got close enough to were the birds we didn't know were even there.
Right.
Does that mean maybe you're trusting the dog's breeding and training more than most people?
Absolutely. Just even the instinct. They have the nose. And just like you said, late season, I let dogs range a little bit farther. And it might be maybe not my flushing dogs, but I will let my pointing dogs range a little bit farther.
Do you find specific challenges in running the two together, a flusher and a pointer? And if you do, what can we do to deal with that? Because sometimes, like the day after tomorrow, I'm hunting with my best friend who's got a Labrador. So what's the etiquette involved in that? And is there anything we can do?
So we're doing a lot of meat hunting, and we've had some of our guides train dogs for, you know, AKC hunt tests and especially on the German Shorthair side. And one thing that they don't like doing is running with flushers, but our guides have really learned to actually like it a lot. And our labs are being trained. They almost start to respect the Shorthairs and vice versa. The pointers start respecting the flushers. And what'll happen is, we have two or three pointers on the ground, and they lock up and they're on point. And especially when I'm guiding, I have one lab usually kind of in the rear of the group of the dogs. And so then I will actually say Stormy okay, or whatever, Stokes okay. And that's their key to go in and flush. And I like that just so that we don't have hunters, especially on birds that sit tight, you know, your quail and maybe some of the partridge and stuff. If those those birds sit tight, I like to have the flusher go in and flush them versus the hunter. So that's just my preference, but we've had some good luck with it. The problem is when you have a flusher that doesn't respect the point and it basically goes in like a tornado, that's a little bit disrespectful in my eyes, and that handler should do a little bit better job of controlling his flusher.
I think you're being very politic with your answer, Trent. I would call it an out of control flusher. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. When it works, it works incredibly well. And you mentioned a great place where that happens a lot as well, and that's Red Bank Ale and Quail out there near Red Bluff, California. One of my favorite places to visit for all sorts of reasons. But on top of that, it is a matter of acquainting both types of dogs with what the other dog is going to do when they get in those situations. Do you actually go out and practice that with dogs?
We do. Personally, we do. And we'll do it, you know, in our off season mainly. We're not doing a lot during season.
Yeah.
But we're doing it in the off season. That's what makes the dogs great during season.
We talked about the probably the number one issue, the biggest mistake hunters make is they're too damn noisy. Are there any others, especially if they're hunting maybe with a professional guide or a place that is unfamiliar to them? What are the other top mistakes that we make when we're a guest somewhere?
Can I have two?
At least. I figured you'd be down to about 22
yeah.
by now.
Yeah, we could do that too. So one thing that I think is very important, if I'm invited on a hunt and it's a guest inviting me, I'm the guest of a guest especially, I don't offer to take my dog. What I do is it's not like a given for me. Like, I want to hunt with my dog and I get that. But I do notice that sometimes when we have guests show up here, the guy that's maybe paying for the bill or the one that invited the guest, he's like, "Oh, I didn't know that we were gonna have 3-4 extra dogs. You know, I'm sorry."
Yeah,
and he starts apologizing up front. And to me, I get it. Like, I want to hunt with my dog. But I think you need to establish that before you go on the trip and say, "Hey, just so you know, I do have a dog. If you want me to bring it, please let me know." You know, I think that's a soft ask.
Yeah.
And rather than just assuming that your dog is to come. Yeah. And we have a group, and I'm not gonna say names or anything, but there are a couple people in the group, and they bring a couple dogs that are high ranging. And the guy that is kind of in charge of the group, he really gets frustrated every year. And I've asked him if he wants me, you know, as the club manager to say something, but it's kind of a sore subject for him. But I think that's one thing is to make sure that you establish that before you go on a trip is, am I bringing my dogs and did this guy invite me or just me or excuse me, and me and my dogs. So.
Yeah, real good point. And, you know, it's funny, in the last few podcasts and over the interim on social media, we've talked a lot recently about what I'll loosely call hunting invitation etiquette.
Yeah.
Whether it's public ground that you're going to show somebody or a private piece that you have access to and you don't want that guy to come back and hunt it again because he's not part of that. Anyway, that's a big one right there. And I'll never forget, I got asked a couple of years ago in a questionnaire somewhere, how do you tell your hunting buddy his dog sucks? And I had some fun with that one. I've probably rewritten it 3 or 4 times. Hopefully it's funny now. But so there's another one. And you said you had two.
I do. My other one is, I can't tell you how many times somebody brings a dog and the dog has never been shot over.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the biggest mistakes, because this is hard to fix if you fix it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bringing a dog that is not gunshot condition, has not had the bird drive, hasn't been brought up with the birds, hasn't went through all the prereqs, in my opinion. And then they want to take it out with a group for their first hunt. And we advise it. No. But there are still some people who's like, "Oh, this dog has the best line and they insist that they take their dog." And at that point, you know, it's out of our control, but we as guides really, really advise that they do not drop that dog on a group hunt for their first hunt. We try to tell people, make sure that you gunshot condition your dog prior to a group hunt, and your first couple hunts should be with one gun. Don't let, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 guns out in the field with your dog when it's so young and still trying to figure it all out.
The record when I was guiding was 8 guns, 1 gun shy dog.
Yeah.
He didn't start that way, but he sure ended that way.
Right.
So I do get this question a lot. We've debated this, not you and me, but me and many others have debated this. In a nutshell, tell us what the most important aspects of gun conditioning a young dog are.
I like to start out slow. What we do is we build bird drive first, and we're getting that dog. It might be on a pigeon, it might be on a chucker, but we're getting the bird drive up And we'll even start with a bumper with wings, you know, with wings strapped around it, just so that they kind of get that feel, the smell. But bird, there's nothing that trains a bird dog better than birds, and that's live birds. And we love to use pigeons. I know that's a touchy subject for some people, but they're a great training bird. And we really like to get that drive up to where we start at a distance, and we'll start 100 yards away with a starter pistol and work our way in. When that dog is going on a retrieve or going after this bird is when we do the shot, so their adrenaline's really high.
That, let me stop you right there, because I want to come back to a term you use that I know you know and most of our listeners will know, but there's somebody out there who's going to say, I don't know what bird drive is. How do you get it? And I'm going to start on, I'm thinking of a particular wire-haired pointing Griffon that we had in our club training group a couple of years ago. And we started with dead, dry, thawed pigeons so that the dog understood what it was. And then eventually we got to a live, we bound the wings, but the dog understood, hey, this is a live bird. And eventually just acquainting this dog with the variations on a real bird started building that, what we call bird drive, and his passion to go and try and catch those things. Am I on the right track there for you guys too?
You're right on. Yeah, we love to see that before we introduce gunshot. Yep.
And then he puts two and two together and says, okay, now I'm chasing after this bird. And Rick and Ronnie Smith, they'll fly those birds and let the dogs chase. And my veterinarian was the same way. Let that dog chase. That's the first time he hears a gunshot, is when he's chasing and freaked out crazy about a bird. Okay, end of discussion on that. But so please, people, do not take your dog, your puppy, to the trap club and walk closer and closer to the line.
Yes. that's not the adrenaline we're looking for. That's more a fear. Yeah. You know, it's not the adrenaline we're looking for.
Yeah. You used a term that I can relate to, because I've never graduated any of my dogs beyond a meat dog. We've got a few NAVDA prizes here and there, but nothing to brag about. But what are the most important skills a dog should have for most of us most of the time?
Does it matter if are you referring to pointing?
Either
or
one.
Flushing?
Yeah, well, let's talk about both, yeah.
So I think control is a big thing, but, you know, I'm kind of stepping on my toes here. There needs to be manners. There needs to be control. And what I mean is this dog just can't be off the wall, out of control, disrespecting every command. Because you saying here and the dog running away from you, that dog's not trained or not trained to that command. And so I really like to see control, and steadiness is good, especially when you get into the trial scene, but that's not our main focus, especially at first. Steadiness is great, but we like to make sure that we do establish a point or a flush. And then we also love to see the retrieve. So we're really going for the point and flush, and then the retrieve, and the retrieve back to hand.
Yeah, in of all of those, you preface it with some fundamental obedience that actually is obeyed. You know, several renowned trainers have reiterated for decades, have said there's really only three things a dog needs to be able to do: go out when you want him to, come back when you want him to, and hold still when you want him to. Those are number one field training objectives, but they're also simple obedience. What do you do in that world? Let's just take a Labrador, for example. We got him in the field and he's walking at heel and the pointers hit a point. What have you done to ensure that that dog is still at heel when he knows there's a bird in front of him and he wants to get it and he knows he's going to be released to it? Do you do anything in the way of training that would help reinforce that?
We do leash training in that instance. So if we would have, and it's almost like an honor drill, if we would have a couple or even one dog on point, let's just use one dog, for instance, one dog on point, and then we want to bring up our lab, we will actually at first, you know, to control, have that control, is bring that dog up on on a leash. And at that point, we'll even sit the dog and sit the lab or the flusher, any kind of flusher. And then we will release either by name or some of our guides use name and then okay. And that's their key to go ahead and go in and flush. But again, I don't want this lab or this flusher, coming in like a tornado and just, and making the competition for the pointers. Now, like it or not, it's still tough for that pointer to hold that point when that lab or that flusher comes in. I mean, that's very tough, and it's almost not fair.
Yeah.
But it's for us, it's a safety issue.
Oh, no doubt about it. And more lodges and outfitters and guides are going to that approach for the reason you described. We'd rather have a dog fly the bird than one of the paying customers who ends up ultimately in front of the other paying customers. How about the other end of that equation, the pointing dogs? What do you do in the off season or with a young dog as you're starting them out? What are the things you do to keep that dog steady once he slams a point?
So we do a lot of flyaway drills.
Yeah.
You mentioned this earlier. And if that dog, and we'll also use some box birds, with actually a release, but even a step. But what we've learned that works really well for us is if this pointer comes in and it wants to become a flusher, so to speak, it comes on point and then wants to start working, and that bird's not running, so this would be a place bird. If that dog does go in, we let that bird fly away.
Yeah.
We will not reward that dog with a shot. We let that bird fly away.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little, because I'm becoming a real believer in Brad Higgins is a trainer in Nevada who talks about the dog, number one, needs to know deep down in its heart of hearts that the only way it's allowed to get a bird, we'll talk about what they do with it afterwards, but if that dog wants a bird in his mouth, it has to come from the human. Mm-hmm. And that means it's either handed to him by the human, or the human knocks it out of the sky, and he knows the human knocks it out of the sky. Are you on the same track?
I am. We do that a lot with our young dogs. Like, even if we're out hunting with a dog,
mm-hmm.
If that dog does not point that bird, we are not shooting that bird. Now, when we invite customers into the field, that changes everything.
Oh, yeah.
But as trainers, we will not reward that pointer with a shot bird if he or she is not doing the pointing.
And back again to the very beginning, all of this is built on a foundation of bird contact. And, as George Hickok says, no birds, no bird dog.
I like that.
Yeah, you can use it. I stole it from George. You can steal it from me.
As long as we mention George.
Yeah. Your flushing breeds again. Let's talk about them, because I hunt with a lot of Labradors, both on TV and then for fun.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep them close enough so that when they do get a bird in the air, we can actually shoot at it with some expectation of hitting it?
We're gonna beat on the flushers here a little bit. So we actually, one thing that we started doing was introducing a little bit of pointing line into our Labradors. And it was from, Tiger Mountain. We bought some dogs from them. We've bought quite a few, and we've actually introduced those into our line. I've noticed that it's been a lot easier to get the dogs now that we have this new line that we're kind of introducing. And we've bred them to our normal flushing Labradors. But we have had a lot easier luck keeping those labs back, and they actually will, their tail locks up. I mean, some of them will wag, but a lot of them almost, I mean, not as high as an English pointer, but their tail will lock up, and it's just a steady point. So that's really helped us. But before that, we have had only flushing labs. And like you said, we have to keep them back. And so what we do is we do introduce the e-collar, when we're bringing them up with the foundation. And then we've learned that tone. We've basically learned to tone our dogs. It used to be whistle. Now we use tone. And it's just so that the customers don't have to hear us blowing the whistle too much.
Or the guy next to you, if you're hunting with a buddy in public access ground, it's the same way. Boy, am I grateful for that tone capability on my collars now. You know, we're just getting warmed up around here. That's Trent Likelighter. I'm Scott Linden. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast, coming to you from Bend, Oregon, and Tacoma, Nebraska. Man, I can't wait to get back there. Trent, I'm going to give you a little bit of a break so I can talk a little bit about the stuff that helps make us money around here. Including Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. Looking forward to talking with you, Dr. Tim, in about 2 hours, actually. You know, this is the time of year when we start kind of reevaluating how our season went, looking at our dog. Is he kind of scrawny? Did he perform to our expectations? Maybe it's time to kind of up your game a little bit when it comes to care and feeding, literally, of your dog. Consider the nutritive value of the dog food you are using now. Take a breath, take a look at the back of that bag, and look at the nutrition. Look at the what they call the guaranteed analysis. See how much protein, see how much fat it has, and then go to drtims.com and compare some of those guaranteed analyses. He's got a whole bunch of varieties out there. And learn why certain ingredients do certain things in certain ways. For example, most of Dr. Tim's dog foods have three different forms of protein, and there's a reason for that. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Go over to the website and look for yourself, drtims.com. Remember, 30% off your first order. Just use the code UPLANDNATION. And once you've bought new dog food, come on over to my new site, uplandnationdeals.com. Yeah, ask your wife. It's Poshmark for us folk. You got stuff you don't want anymore? Sell it there. You need stuff you don't got? Buy it there. I like to say pro-level gear at entry-level prices, and you're helping make new hunters a little bit more effective in the field. Kids' stuff is always shipped free. Free shipping on your first sale or your first purchase. I could sure use your e-collars in our inventory right now. So if you're upgrading to some of those new products on the market right now, consider letting us help you sell your old e-collars to a gigantic national audience. Thank you. Our Handle It segment is brought to you by HappyJackInc.com. Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies for everything from your dog's pads to your coat. Take care of parasites, fleas and ticks, and everything else. It's all at HappyJackInc.com. You know, I was thinking about this for the last couple weeks. I'm a little bit away from the puppy thing right now, but it came across in somebody's email. How do you reward a young dog, or if you're teaching a less young dog, a more mature dog, some new skills? Are you using food treats? If you are, and I'm not going to argue that one way or the other, but if you're using food treats, consider this. Again, going back to all the great trainers that I've worked with over the years, there's one easy-to-access, inexpensive product that will probably do you the most good for the least investment. Hot dogs. Cut it into little bits and use it for everything from teaching your dog to track ground scent to giving them a reward when they do whatever skill you're teaching, when they do it well. The reason I like hot dogs and other soft food treats is they're generally gone in one gulp. No crunchy chewing required, so the dog doesn't lose his focus. And also, if your dog is like my dog, he doesn't choke on the little dry bits as he's taking in a deep breath and ready to race off to the next job. Little bits of hot dogs. If you're using food treats at all, that's an easy one to do. And if he's still awake, let's bring Trent Likelighter back from Pheasant Bonanza in Tacoma, Nebraska. Trent, are you still there with me?
I am. That was good. A good nap.
Okay, good.
No.
So you're fresh and ready.
Right.
Do I need to give you a little bit of hot dog?
Yeah, I'll take a token economy. You and I both have the teaching background, so yeah. There we go.
Yeah, I guess I forgot that. And you were a coach too, weren't you?
Yeah, that's what I went to the school for. So
Yeah. I guess technically I was a coach too, but my teams had noisemakers in their faces.
All right.
Okay.
Very good.
So, do you guys use food treats when you train?
We do as puppies. We start out that way, and then we like to, and as you will, I would hope you'd agree, after a certain time, we like to just use that positive reinforcement, and it becomes almost like a voice treat. They love that, just that affirmation and good dog, good Stokes, whatever that dog might be. And we just change it to voice commands after a while. But yes, we do use them.
You know, the other one, and I wrote about this several places over the years. There are all sorts of other things we can use to reward a dog. And you just hit on the one that's most important, because you can do that instantaneously. You've always got a voice with you, so you don't need to worry about a treat or a clicker or anything else, mm-hmm. or a chew toy or a regular toy or whatever, like some of those people use. But, you know, out here in the West, when we're hunting early in the season, who needs a food treat when you got water with you?
That's true.
And here's one that maybe we all take it for granted, but just for the record, they're called bird dogs for a reason. What is the best reward you can bestow on a bird dog? Another bird. So cut him loose to go hunting again.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So this is really for you. sorry for the lecture, everybody. Okay. I want to get back to pointing dog training just a little bit, or dogs in general, if it's applicable. But Trent, you've been around hundreds of dogs. You've trained hundreds of dogs. What is the one more thing we should always do to a dog? What can we do more of, or should we never forget to do?
Be consistent.
Tell me more.
I know that's broad, but when you set your commands, and I don't care what your commands are, they can be, you can use place, you can use sit, you can use here, and you can, I mean, come versus here. There's so many different commands. One thing that I hear all the time, come here, here, pup. I mean, it's just so many different things. Dogs understand short words. I mean, they might understand you because it's your dog, but try to be consistent. And if you're going to use here, and make sure they understand it. Here, you know, draw it out a little bit so that they understand that here means come here. And when I say be consistent, always show that dog a way out. So if you're going to end up, like, especially with e-collars, if you're going to put pressure on a dog with an e-collar, and there's a fine line on who should be using them, and some of the handlers should have them on their neck.
Yeah.
But you have to be consistent. You cannot use it at one time and then all of a sudden, you know, forget about it the next 10 times, because you're just devaluing that whole correction. So for me, it's truly being consistent in everything you do with training. And if you're going to use commands, be consistent with them and make sure that you're using them all the time. Some people will even just, they'll say load up one time, they say kennel the next. I mean, it's just be consistent.
And the corollary to that, check me on this, is never give a command you can't enforce.
Absolutely. Yeah. If that dog is running, I mean, and bolting, and they're yelling here, 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 you are just wasting your voice. I mean, that dog's not going to turn around on a split second, and especially when that dog's out of range.
Well, plus, go ahead.
Well, and you just sound like an idiot in the field.
which I do anyway, but that's not the question. What it also does is it teaches that dog that, well, I only have to follow that command sometimes.
You're right. It devalues the command.
And as we were discussing in a deep philosophical moment while panting to catch our breath after a climb last weekend, intermittent positive reinforcement is the best way to untrain a dog.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. 100% agree.
All right, let's turn around, get up, walk into the kennel. What are the pieces of equipment that are right there by the door that you guys are always using?
We always have leashes and flat buckle collars. You know, it's our go-to all the time. We have long leashes. We have on our training table, we always have long leashes, regular leashes, flat buckle collars. We do a little bit with pinch collars, and we have an assortment of bumpers, and we even have a couple of your nice bumpers, the Real Feel bumpers.
Thank you.
But my big pitch on that is, especially when a dog is young, is to use as many different retrieving tools as you can. And that helps if you ever do have to go to force fetching, it really helps that dog learn that different things in his or her mouth are okay. And they can get the same positive reinforcement, bringing back something that feels a little bit, I should say, less good in their mouth.
You know, that is a point that's never been made quite that way. And it is the comfort level they have with putting almost anything in their mouth. We usually take the other tack and say, he should know that anything I want him to pick up, he's got to pick up. Well, that's kind of scary. But if instead it's here's it's just laying around, go pick it up and play with it for a while. All of a sudden it's a different kind of, I guess I'll call it mindset towards stuff like that. Do you use any funny stuff? I mean, there are trick trainers out there who like to put a sledgehammer into the bumper pile and things like that.
Yeah, we do hammers.
Yeah.
So just a regular, not a big sledgehammer, but we'll use small hammers. We have a lot of odd-shaped logs.
Yeah.
One's heavy on one side. And then we'll actually weight some things down on one side. And that gives that dog, you know, as well as I do, there isn't a bird that is even, you know, it doesn't matter where they grab it. It's going to be unbalanced. I mean, one side or the other is going to be heavier than the other. And that's what we're looking for, is to give that dog just a different feel in his mouth with all the different tools we use. But we love your bumpers. I mean, those things work great. It kind of has that feeling like a bird, and it's still easy to throw in the barrel. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. Spent a lot of time developing that thing. And now if everybody would buy a couple hundred, I'd be all right. I wouldn't have to do this anymore.
Hey, that's all right. And then we also have in our lockers back here, we have cap guns, and we use small gauge shotguns for our training. So,
yeah. Do you get a lot of questions from your guests while you're in the field about how you're handling dogs, or the shooting etiquette? We want to get to that in a minute as well. But what are the most common things they ask you about your dogs when you're guiding?
You know, when I'm guiding, I personally don't get a lot of questions. It's probably because I don't talk a lot to the dogs, but afterwards, I will get comments, and that, to me, that's a home run for me. Is we just right before Christmas, I had a group, and they mentioned at the end of the hunt, like, how did you get those dogs to go on both sides of the food plot? Because we had a pretty wide, I would just say probably 100 yards wide, and we ended up taking a food plot all in one push, and I had four pointers, and I had one flusher, so I was running five dogs, and I kept them going from side to side. And the guy at the end just said, "How did you do that?" And I said, "Well, they understand me, and I've taught these dogs when I say over, you know, and give them a hand signal that they go over and hunt in this side, and then they come back and they check in with me, and I give them an over to the right, and they just continually check back and forth." And for me, it was just me having that connection and that training, the prereq training that we're talking about, with my guide strength.
You know, you brought up something and dogs are like poker players. They have tells. Bad poker players, they have tells. Uh-huh. And if we know what those tells are, we can also know when to give the command, because timing is everything. As you said, if they're running away chasing a deer, it's not the time to teach sit. So are these dogs, have you figured out what those are and that's when you're giving commands, or do you, or are they just so loyal and enamored with you as an incredible human that they check in with you naturally?
I'm going to go on the first one. I'd like to say the second, but I can't take credit on that. So, no, I've learned that when, you know, it seems like if I'm walking down a, let's just say a road or a mowed strip, like we have, you seen out here, we do a lot of strip hunting. What I've noticed is they go in and they're not catching wind or anything. And it's almost like they just kind of peek their head out of the cover into the strip. And if I'm there, they give me a cue. And at that point, I don't even have to say anything. I either give them a left or a right over where I want them to direct. Now, this is where it becomes this is when they check in with me. I'm not asking for their attention, right? So I'm not trying to overhandle them. And that's one of the first things I said that a lot of people do wrong. That would be me blowing my whistle, and basically the dog's hunting. I blow my whistle, especially on a flusher. They sit, they look at me, and then I give them over left or right. Let the dog hunt, right? I'm only doing this when this dog checks in with me and gives me that connection, that eye contact.
When you were there and I was there and we were learning from great teachers how to be hopefully great teachers as well, one of the terms that was really fashionable was learning readiness.
I like it.
And we can talk about that in the evolution of a dog as it gets older, but we can also talk about it in the moment. As you said, the dog is running around doing its doggy work, and then it kind of glances at you, maybe just out of his peripheral vision, but he's checking in with you in a very subtle way. That's when he's ready. That's when you deliver, and that's exactly what you were describing. So it, rather than, like you said, blow the whistle or yell their name and then expect them to follow, wait till they're ready if you can help it. And granted, if they're heading for a railroad track or something else, you gotta draw the line somewhere.
Absolutely. And this is a dog string that I've done a lot of work with. So it's not like I can't just go grab, three random dogs out of the kennel and expect them to have that connection. And it's going to be totally different. I'm going to take it the way it is. So,
yeah. So let's graduate to, after the point. I'm your guest today, and we got, Duke's great grandsons and daughters out there, and they're all on point, and we've got your favorite black lab at your heel. What are you going to do for me, to me, with me, to ensure that I actually hit something when a bird gets up?
The first thing I'm going to do is try to get you as close to the pointers as we can, to where I feel comfortable and they feel comfortable, because it's natural to stop, and it might be 40 yards from the point, right? And so I'm going to advance you as safely as I possibly can, and then I'm going to say, okay, get your footing right. Footing is so important. I'm always worried about safety as well as guns up. That's the one thing I do say a lot in the field is guns up. But I want people with their guns up, finger off the trigger, safety on, until they're ready to mount that gun and take that shot. And for me, footing is so important, because if you're screwed in the ground, we don't know. We have an idea where that bird might go. But as you know, once you start trying to predict it, it goes the exact opposite. You think it's gonna go north, it comes south. And so footing is so important, and I always tell them to line up their belt buckle with where the bird is going to go, where they think that bird's going to go, and that way they have a good swing left and a good swing right. And to me, footing is so important. And then the next thing would be bring your gun up to your cheek. Don't bring your cheek down to your gun. So you're gonna bring the gun up to your head versus you're putting your head down on the gun.
The belt buckle thing, it just rings a bell for me. I'm sorry, that is brilliant, and I'm going to try and remember it. Maybe I will actually learn how to shoot this summer. But, you're right. Of course, when we know, we can stand there all we want, and the dogs, we know where their noses are pointed, and so we can kind of guess where the birds are. But is there any general rule of thumb about where we think they'll go when they get up? I know we can't predict it all the time, but is there a generality there that, and can we orchestrate that somehow?
We have a, as you know, we have some high winds here, and a bird might not take the wind right away, but generally once that bird is up, it's going to hit that wind and it's going to go with that wind. So that's what we see a lot of times when we're hunting, but I always look at the dog's head. And just like you mentioned, if that dog's head is up high, that bird's still quite a ways up ahead. If that dog has pinned its head down, it's kind of pointing down, and it still doesn't always work, but this is just, you know, this is just what I've used as my guidance. But then that bird's going to be a little bit closer. And obviously when you have a bird that's farther out versus closer, you have a lot more time to get ready. And most shots, the first shot, especially with people using automatics, is they shoot too quick. And I always like to say, you know, the three or the four B's, and that's the butt, the body, the beak, bang. So take your time. I mean, it's a kind of a 1-2-3 shot, and that's the, I guess that's the tip I would give shooters.
You know, if everybody would just pattern their gun at 30 yards, their eyes would be open wide to how small a pattern is, and thus we should wait a little, you know, at least one beat longer.
Yes.
So when we're approaching a dog on point or the bird that's beyond the dog on point, do you try and direct that hunter in any specific route?
No, the only, you know, most of our stuff is group hunting. If I had a single hunter, I would basically let them advance right up to the dog. And then I would just say, okay, you know, be ready for 45 to the left, 45 to the right. Mm-hmm. Generally, that's going to take care of that shot. And that's, you know, kind of the belt buckle deal.
Yeah.
But as you know, sometimes we have a turnaround bird that comes up and goes right over our head. And at that point, I don't even want them to take that shot until if they're by themselves in the field, I want them to shuffle their feet, square up, and then lower the gun. And again, belt buckle out where that bird's going. They still have plenty of time. That bird just went up and over us. You know, it's not that far away.
Love it. And the idea of doing it in that order, it's easy to say and hard to do. We all want to get the gun up and start shooting, even as it's crossing over our head, when we would be way better off to spend the second and a half to turn around.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that people might not understand what screwed in the ground means is if you would actually take an unloaded gun and put your footing the way that you think it is, put your gun up into the wall to where, you know, you basically feel comfortable, close your eyes and swing left 5 times and swing right with your eyes closed. And when you think that you put that gun back on that point, it's going to amaze you how far left or how far right you are. And that's just because of the nature of your body. It's the way that you swing that gun and the way that your footing is screwed into the ground.
Well, that actually reminds me, I need to get a gun out and have it in the office here. I'm working on a new gun mount. So
hey, there you go.
I'm not going to do it mentally. I got to do it with something in my hand. So thank
that's
you.
That's great.
you mentioned electronic training collars, and virtually everybody is either using one or wishes they were using one for all sorts of reasons. And by the way, everybody, if you have any to sell, go to uplandnationdeals.com, please. I got so many requests for used e-collars. So anyway, so back to the question. So what is the biggest mistake people make when they're using an electronic training collar?
They don't collar condition the dog. Mm-hmm. And we can go back into that, but they basically strap this collar on. They have the transmitter and they think that this dog just understands it. You know, this is indirect pressure where this dog doesn't even at first doesn't even know where it's coming from. It's like, why did that just happen? Why did I feel that? And so just like in the simple obedience, you have to teach a dog the way out of any kind of pressure you're going to give him or her. And we do a lot of collar conditioning with our simple obedience. We do it with forcing a dog to a kennel and basically saying kennel and giving them a little bit of a tingle all the way to the kennel. They get in the kennel, pressure off, and then we turn around, say here, and we give them a little pressure to until they come here. We're doing that all with a long lead, so we can show that dog how to get out of this pressure.
Yeah, let me just make that real clear. The dog needs to know the command before you ever apply any electronic stimulation. Am I correct?
Spot on. Yeah.
You don't teach a command with an e-collar. You reinforce a learned command, just for the record.
Okay. And I've seen it back in my early days of some other younger trainers, and they strap a dog on, or a dog collar on, and they start using it, and the dog bolts, and then we end up looking for a dog, you know. And it's just, you have to teach that dog the command before it knows to come back here. So
long lead is a great way to do it. Treats with the young dogs, another great way to bait them into the kennel, for example. And I've done a million of those over the years. Speaking of dogs and all of that, the reality of a commercial hunting operation is that you always have more dogs than you really know what to do with. And I guess that's one way to put it. And some dogs are just, they're great dogs, but their career as a lodge dog, as a guide dog, is over. You've come up with a solution to this that I think is just novel and wonderful. Tell me a little bit about your organization.
So we started a nonprofit, and it's called CAMO with a K, so K-A-M-O. And the K-A is canine adoption, and then the M-O is mentoring outdoors. So it's a dual purpose, but it's canine adoption and mentoring outdoors. And what we have done is I just kept seeing a need. You know, I've been doing this hunt club industry now for 15 years and even started training before that. For myself and for a few other customers 2-3 years before that. And I kept noticing that somebody would come to us either with a dog that was gun shy and they couldn't get the dog out of the gun shy, but they were a one dog family, right? Their wife's like, this is your dog. You've committed to it. You get it for 10 to 12 years, however long this dog lives. And I get it. I mean, that's a tough, he might've screwed it up or it might've been a bad genetics, but most of the time, gun shyness is man-made, and fireworks is very, very popular. And we get quite a few of those dogs, and they come to us and they say, hey, we have this dog. It might not hunt. It might be retired. But what we're seeing is that if we can provide this dog a new home, and it might be with a new family that's not a hunting family, and we're getting people from all over the nation that are requesting these dogs. Our primarily focus is sporting dogs. So we're looking for any kind of sporting dogs. Now, we did rehome a couple house dogs. One was a LaShawn. I've never even heard of it before. But we rehomed a LaShawn this year. So what I'm seeing is, and these clubs are having the same issue, is when they have a dog that's getting to that 10-plus years of age, that dog still has a couple years left of hunting, but they need to replace the dog with a younger dog that can go out on a guide string 5-6 days a week. And so we're trying to reach out and basically let people know we're here. We are trying to get these dogs in homes, and we have people right now waiting for dogs if they're the right fit for the dog that comes in.
So so does it matter where I live and where the dog is, or where the potential adoptee family is?
Absolutely not. We actually have a guy. We've sent 13 dogs to date. We've only been going for just over a year, but we've done we've sent out 13 dogs successively. None of them have came back. But what's neat is we've even had a couple dogs that came in as they weren't quite what a hunt club needed. They weren't that standout guide dog. And we have, I think there's 2 or 3 of them right now that are hunting almost every weekend with their new owner. And we've sent them to California. We've sent them to Texas. We do have quite a few in Nebraska and the Midwest area. But I have a gentleman in Austin, Texas that calls me, if not every week, every other week, asking when his dog's going to be coming in. So,
wow. So if we have a dog, or we want a dog that might fit into this CAMO organization. How do we reach out and get the process started?
Yep. So we have a surrender form on our website, and then we also have an adoption form, and it's a request. We want to make sure that we'll actually call you too, you know, afterwards to make sure that you're the right fit for this dog. But the website is camoinc.org. So camoinc.org.
I had to type it down. camoinc.org. camoinc.org.
There you go. Yep. camoinc.org. Yep.
Hard to pronounce. Easy to type.
It is.
One dot between ink and org. camoinc.org. Well, yep. It's a spectacular idea, and I wish you well with that. It's not like you don't have anything better to do. You've got a full plate on top of everything else. In fact, I just recommended you as a trick shooter to an organization. I hope they're calling you real soon.
Awesome.
Yeah, so stand by, and I'll take my commission anyway in puppies, all right?
Okay, we can do that.
Trent, if there was anything else, by the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Trent Likelighter. He's with Pheasant Bonanza in Takema, Nebraska, and your website is pheasantbonanza.com.
Correct.
I'm Scott Linden, your host. If you were going to leave us with anything that has to do with hunting or dogs, what's your final thought on that?
You know, I'm going to have to just go back to consistency. It could be with the hunting, with the training, with dog work, dog handling. Just be consistent. And, you know, it's like set goals. That's another thing is set goals for yourself. Individually set them for your dog, where you want to be at with your dog by next season, where you want to be at with your family, your faith, your finances, your future, just all the, and your fitness. You know, here's the deal. If we're not fit enough to be in the field, then that dog's the one that is going to suffer. So.
Yeah. All good bits of advice. Learn more at pheasantbonanza.com, or if you're interested in adopting or surrendering a dog, camoinc.org, camo with a K. Trent Likelighter, always great to talk with you. I'd rather do it in person next time. So maybe next fall.
That sounds great. Let's get it on the books.
Thanks for being part of the Upland Nation.
Thank you.
And the rest of the Upland Nation, don't go away. Lots more to talk about, including a public access tip. Warning, for that matter. All right, but first on the docket, the Upland Nation Index Survey. Do it every year. Thank you. 1,800 of you filled out the form. It's a long one. It's, you know, 35 questions, but once you did, you were eligible for that Mossberg shotgun drawing. Going to announce a new winner very soon. One of the questions I asked was apropos of last week's podcast and also the level of what I'll politely call ignorance out there when it comes to how do we keep the right and the privilege to hunt public land alive. So I asked the question, what are the three most important issues facing upland hunting in the next 5 years? 1,800 of you gave me your answers, and it was mind-bogglingly clear. 72.5% of you said the most important thing is providing more access to more public hunting ground. Kind of like what we were talking about last week, especially if you can help somebody obtain that access. All right. Next on the list, the second most important issue related. 57% of you said mismanagement of public land and habitat is a big issue. And man, oh man, isn't that the truth? We've all been there. So those two combined, plus recruiting new hunters, 40% of you thought that was the most important or one of the three most important aspects. All those together, and I'm not going to lecture you, but I am going to just make the point one more time. Without new hunters, There's no money for management or acquisition of more public hunting ground. It's as simple as that. Your license, your tags, your permits, that's not enough. People need to be out there buying guns and ammo, because that money goes to the feds, who then turn around and send it back to the states based on how many license holders they have. That's the Pittman-Robertson Act in a nutshell. Okay, end of lecture. I apologize, but it was worth it to get it off my chest. Okay. Hey, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Gunner.com. Their kennels have been tested and proven to save lives in real accidents. Go watch some of the videos on how they build and how they try to destroy their own dog crates. Sign up for the mailing list. You'll get early access on all the exclusive offers from Gunnerware to the accessories to go in and on or around your crate. That new feed bin, all sorts of cool stuff. It's all at Gunner.com. All right, I'm not a Luddite. If you don't know what that is, look it up, L-U-D-D-I-T-E. I like technology and I use it whenever I can. I also admit that when there's a 12-step program for people who still love paper topo maps, I will join up. I'll probably fall off the wagon periodically. But here we are. This Land Is Your Land is brought to you by FindBirdHuntingSpots.com, all sorts of places to go, plus training and care tips for your dog, hunting advice for you. Like I said, technology is a wonderful thing when it works. And back in the days when it was new, somebody coined the phrase garbage in, garbage out. Well, you can't get garbage out if they never put the garbage in, and that's one of the problems with some of these online mapping apps. I was just poking around trying to learn more about mine, and I thought, well, I'll just look up that public access walk-in area I was at last Saturday. I went to the spot, I zoomed in on the satellite image, I found the gate that I walked through. On the other side of that gate, it was public, but not on the mapping app. The problem sometimes in some states is the states are not furnishing that information in a timely manner to the online mapping app folks. Let me give you one example. Close to home, Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife last updated their public access maps in August of 2019. Well, that doesn't help you when you're looking to find that spot that you heard there was birds in this week. Now, some states are better than others, so you might get lucky in them, but the first thing you probably ought to look into, call your mapping app customer service number, find out when they've last updated all the public access maps in the area you're going to. And just one more tip in that area, if you are not finding some of those, look for one of the layers that may be called a travel management area or something like that. I know it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? But maybe that's where the public access spots are layered. Good luck on that. It's a good reason to always get your individual state's walk-in hunting lands atlas, whether it's the hard copy or the online copy, every year. They're most often brought current and all of the deals done for that year in about mid-August. So keep looking and see you in the field real soon. Real soon. I'm headed for Northern Nevada. Wish me luck. I'm taking my snow pants. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast. Thank you, Trent Likelighter, for all your on-the-ground, hard-won wisdom. Appreciate that. I learned something. I hope everybody else who listens also learned. If you did, please give us a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts. We're talking all day, every day at the Wing Shooting USA and Upland Nation Facebook pages. If you've given us a review recently, I appreciate that. Thank you, BirdDog0903 and Joel FP. You're very kind. Appreciate your remarks. Speaking of remarks, here's your quote for the week from John Winokur. He says, both humans and dogs love to play well into adulthood. And individuals from both species occasionally display evidence of having a conscience. Think of that what you will. Be kind to your family. Be good to your friends. And give your dog a hug for me. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening.